Sometimes it's hard to admit all we're feeling inside. I am a settler, someone who benefits enormously from the destructive fossil fuel-based economy that we have here, as well as the unlawful appropriation of indigenous lands. And at the same time, I'm someone who supports the spirit of reconciliation. In the last few weeks, have provided ample opportunity to reflect on what this means for me personally and for us. This week, I've been called to acknowledge and witness that First Nations are nations, not just communities within Canada, not just ethnic groups living under Canadian law. They are not our First Nations. In many cases, with no treaties signed, the building of industrial infrastructure without permission of the government of that nation is illegal occupation. And to go and arrest residents who are protesting this intrusion on their own territory, well, that's just nuts. And this is exactly what has happened with the Coastal GasLink pipeline and the RCMP invasion is in support of this illegal activity. This month, protests occurred in front of my place of work. On February 14th, protesters aimed to block myself and my colleagues from doing our jobs in the BC Public Service. Was this an inconvenience? Oh, for sure. But reconciliation isn't something we can do only when it's convenient. Reconciliation isn't a nice-to-have feature of a left-wing lifestyle. These are the thoughts that are starting to come in my head as I read through the news and through the comments of friends who are standing with the Wet'suwet'en people. In this case, the Wet'suwet'en First Nation in its traditional government system, including the role of the hereditary chiefs who are opposing the pipeline, they have title over their unceded territory, and this has already been established with the Supreme Court of Canada. So to me, reading this, it's like approving a pipeline through their territory without their authorization would be like the states building a pipeline through Canada without getting the Canadian government's authorization. So to me, these protests and this work is about acknowledging First Nations as nations and their land as, in many cases, illegally occupied. The Canadian Unitarian Council, of which we are a member congregation, has formally issued a position in support of the hereditary chiefs. And this month, our charity is RAVEN, an organization whose name is an acronym standing for Respecting Aboriginal Values and Environmental Needs. This month, the month that we're raising money for RAVEN, the Wet'suwet'en has launched with RAVEN two separate legal actions. It's really neat, so I'm going to read you exactly what they've written on the RAVEN website. Legal action number one, supported by hereditary chiefs representing all the five clans of the Wet'suwet'en, asking for a judicial review of the project for the Coastal GasLink pipeline granted by the BC Environmental Assessment Office last October. The chiefs are asking the court to cancel the extension because BC failed to properly assess the project's potential harms, including the risk of increased gender-based violence caused by transient workers in industrial camps, and according with the findings and calls to action of the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Legal action number two is a constitutional challenge asking the federal court to declare that Canada has a constitutional duty to keep the country's greenhouse gas emissions well within the Paris Agreement limit of 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. They're standing up for all of this, all of us in this case. On behalf of the Wet'suwet'en youth and future generations, this action also argues that Canada's failure to do its fair share to avert a climate catastrophe would breach the equality provisions of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. This is landmark stuff. If successful, the lawsuit could lead to far-reaching changes to Canada's environmental legislation. That's pretty amazing. And here we are in the middle of all of it, our congregation and the Canadian Unitarian Council. I encourage you as the offering baskets pass your row to please give generously. Anyone who feels moved to do so is invited to come up to the chalice table to light a candle of remembrance and hope. So that no one has to reach across the flame, please light the candles from the back of the bowl to the front. And for those less able to come up to the front, please get the attention of Victoria, who will bring a candle to you. To honor these acts and this important time to be here and be alive, let us be in a spirit of mindfulness. The gifts of the congregation will now be most gratefully received.
That was beautiful. These past few weeks, I've been spending as much time as I can at direct actions led by Indigenous youth. I haven't had any part in organizing these actions. I'm simply showing up, adding my presence and the privilege that I carry as a settler with Western European ancestry in support of these youth and what they're fighting for. As an uninvited occupant on these lands, who benefits from ongoing colonization, and in whose name the Canadian government is forcing destructive industry through the Wet'suwet'en territory, it feels like the least I can do. I want to acknowledge, too, that not all of us are able to show up physically to actions like this, though we may want to, and there are many ways to act as allies and accomplices. For me, it is possible, and so it feels important. I've learned a lot simply by being present, about what it means to follow Indigenous law and leadership. For our purposes today, I'm going to focus specifically on what I've noticed about intergenerational solidarity at these actions. Now, just to be super clear, I'm just relating my observations, and I certainly don't speak on behalf of any Indigenous person or community. It's very possible that I will misrepresent something, and please do let me know afterwards if that is the case. One of the first things that I noticed was that although it was very clearly the Indigenous youth who were leading these occupations, and specifically, I'm talking about the occupation at the Ministry of Energy, Mines, and Petroleum Resources on January 21st into the morning of January 22nd, and the occupation of the ceremonial gates of the legislature from February 6th to 11th. Though youth were leading these actions, they were never acting alone. Throughout these past weeks, wherever I have seen these brave youth taking a stand, there have been elders, aunties, uncles, family members, and community members standing right along with them. And it's clear that these young people know in their bones that they're not alone. Takaya Blaney, a 19-year-old Two-Spirit artist and activist from Tla'amin Nation, cited in an Instagram post, quote, "We do this so that future generations won't have to. It's because of the labor of our parents and grandparents' generation that we are allowed to gather in groups larger than three, wear our regalia, sing our songs," end quote. I heard Takaya say as much in person on more than one occasion. These youth leaders have inherited both the responsibility and the pride of being protectors of their people, land, and waters. Their actions are guided by the awareness that they, too, will be elders and ancestors, and that that is a responsibility. What a profoundly interconnected and powerful place from which to act. And though the youth are the ones leading these particular actions, it doesn't mean that the elders' words and teachings have no place. Indeed, their songs, teachings, and presence are deeply valued and honored. Halfway through the occupation of the ledge, when the Indigenous youth had spent 3 nights and 4 days outside in the cold and rain, with no resolution in sight, they put out a call specifically for support from their Indigenous relations. It said, quote, "Indigenous youth never stand alone, and we need the strength of all community members, drummers, singers, artists, and leaders to maintain resistance." For the remaining nights after this call went out, until that particular action ended, Groups of drummers, singers, and dancers from various nations showed up. I heard of Nechalnath and Haida, and I'm sure there were others represented as well. They offered songs and dances for hours into the night, and everyone benefited. It was uplifting, community building, and strengthening. This community of the Unitarian Universalist, what are we called, First Unitarian Church of Victoria, has been thinking a lot about resilience over the past month. And if you ask me, those days at the ledge are one of the most beautiful examples of resilience that I've ever had the privilege of witnessing. Reaching out to community, recognizing that in order to keep going in the ways that this moment is asking you to, you'll need more than physical support, though that is also essential. You'll also need community to care for your spirit and your emotional and mental well-being. And just as the elders were honored by the young ones, the respect flowed in both directions. When it was their turn at the mic, I heard proud aunties and fathers saying, "That's my niece, that's my son." The elders spoke to the context in which the young ones were fighting and reminded everyone of the centrality of family and relationship. They passed on teachings and lessons from their own life experience as land protectors. They offered song and ceremony. Being in the presence of such apparent, strong, and loving solidarity between elders and young adults filled me with many complex emotions. There are feelings of awe and humility at the resilience of these people and their cultures who have endured so much and who continue to contend with so much horror. There is tenderness, joy, and gratitude for all the love that I've witnessed in its many forms. And there's also sadness, because all of this reminds me that the culture that I belong to doesn't seem to encourage closeness between the generations in such a way. There are exceptions to that, of course. Personally, as I said earlier, I've been blessed with the presence in my life of some really wonderful, wise, and persistent mentors. But that doesn't change the fact that the dominant North American settler culture seems to have left behind the social position of elder and forgotten the elder's role in raising and teaching younger generations. Now, I'm using the term elder very intentionally and sparingly. From the teachings that I've received, elder is a title that is earned. It's not a given that anyone who has lived a long time automatically becomes an elder. But those who have earned their gray hairs certainly have more potential to fulfill the demands of this job. It's kind of like the term ally, and I've been hearing the phrase, ally is a verb. Elder is also a verb. It's a way of being in the world. That's how I'm talking about it today, at least. And I want to acknowledge my teacher in these matters, Stephen Jenkinson, who speaks with extraordinary eloquence about the function of elderhood and the many consequences for a culture of not having it. This missing understanding about eldership is deeply connected to the fact that we seem to find ourselves in a time of intergenerational war, almost. And I am actually a fan of generational theory, which is the idea that different generations have distinct characteristics based on the era in which they came of age and the influences of their parents and grandparents. But I think that this generational division has gone too far. Millennials are being accused of being lazy and entitled and of killing off everything from democracy to the napkin industry. And more recently, the phrase "okay boomer" has gained popularity, which, though cathartic in some moments, has the dangerous implication of dismissing everything a person has to say based on their age. I don't think this comes from nowhere. Most of us were probably raised in extremely age-segregated ways. We live in a culture that celebrates independence and transience above enduring connections to family, community, or place. Internet algorithms encourage us to become comfortable only with those who are most similar to ourselves. And to top it off, the speed of change in language and technology can make us feel that anyone who can't keep up is irrelevant. And that is a very dangerous inner voice that can appear on both sides of the generational gap. Yes, I think young people can be dismissive and impatient and feel as though anyone more than 10 years their senior will never properly understand them. And I've also heard older folks express that they feel outdated, a burden, that making space for young people to step into leadership means that they have to disappear. I've heard this, and I hope you'll hear in my words today a plea to let that narrative go. We need you, and we need each other. The service that I did at Capitol last year, which is the other Unitarian congregation in town, had the same name as this one, but it was totally different. That one focused much more on the realities that young adults are living with these days. I'm going to go over just the main themes from that more briefly right now. First, we young adults are striving to find new ways of living because the evidence says that the way things have been going for the past little while hasn't turned out so well. This search is happening under some very real conditions of debt, poverty, overeducation, underemployment, and unstable housing. Young adults are also struggling with isolation. We know community is important, but we have a hard time reaching out. It's so easy to turn to the low-pressure option of online connection, when what we really need are real-life relationships, IRL. This is having a big impact on our mental health, as is the climate crisis. There's a profound existential anxiety that comes from living in a society that is, for the most part, carrying on with business as usual while the world is quite literally burning. And finally, in this summary, I want to pass on that I've heard many young adults express a strong desire for more meaningful relationships with older generations. In a panel of millennial Unitarian Universalists that I was on 2 years ago, we used words like hunger, craving, starving, when talking about our desire for mentorship and eldership in our lives. People to teach us the lessons of experience, to inspire us through example, and people who aren't our parents to hear us and advise us in times of struggle. Not to have all the answers, or to tell us that everything will be okay, but to really be with us in the thick of it all, to show us that we're not alone. This is the feeling that I have when I sing Guide My Feet. And I could hear echoes of it, too, in the song that Abby sang for us, You Must Love Me. So that's a bit about what's going on for us young adults. Let's talk about the older generations for a minute. Because as it turns out, those challenges that I talked about that young people are facing are not specific only to young people. Compared to millennials, baby boomers on average do have more financial resources to spare, but poverty does not discriminate by age, nor does an emotional and spiritual sensitivity to the times that we're living in. I joined a Soul Matters group for the first time this year, and for those who aren't familiar, this is a small group of people connected to this church who meet monthly throughout the year to check in with each other on a deep level. Yes, I am the youngest person in that group by about 30 years, probably. And yes, I wish that were different. And it's been quite a humbling and amazing experience for me. It's really opened my eyes in new ways to realize that every person in that group is struggling with something, and that for some, this group was quite a unique opportunity to talk about their struggles. Some of the things that I've witnessed that older generations specifically are dealing with in my Soul Matters group and elsewhere include chronic health challenges, isolation, there's that again, and especially amongst the women and for those who take on feminized labor, being overburdened by caring for others. I'm also going to go out on a limb and speculate that on the other side of that coin that is young people's existential angst, there is an answering anxiety from older generations who grieve the world that their children and grandchildren are inheriting. I'm seeing some nods. Good. So what does intergenerational solidarity look like? Let's come back to the image that I started with, of Indigenous youth grounded in their culture and history and inheritance, asserting their power and standing up to the forces that threaten our world, and of their elders standing alongside them, offering guidance and support and beaming with pride and purpose. Most of us here probably come from a very different context to this experience, and I'm not saying that we should try to be other than what we are. But I do think that we can work on becoming more fully ourselves by moving through that self-talk that keeps us apart, and by reaching out to get to know each other better and lifting each other up. There are some wonderful examples out there of how individuals of different generations can support each other practically and materially. I know of some Unitarian Universalists who have created partnerships between older folks with resources and younger folks with physical ability to buy land together and farm it. These avenues are critical to explore, and I really encourage you to keep having these conversations with each other. For this moment, though, I want to focus on the less tangible kinds of support, the simplicity and complexity of relationship building. Because intergenerational solidarity, like all allyship, only really works when it is grounded in relationship. And relationship building is a skill, and skills take practice. There will no doubt be times when we feel the urge to roll our eyes or shake our heads in exasperation at each other. So be patient and be kind with yourselves and each other. And above all, be persistent. Don't give up on each other. And here's a not-so-secret secret. Church communities like this one are in a great position to start this work. This is one of the few places in my life that there are already those seeds, and sometimes more than seeds, leafy green shoots, and even blossoms, of really meaningful intergenerational relationships. We're already all here with the intention to create community and help each other through this world. My challenge to you, then, is to go beyond what's comfortable and familiar. Be something more for someone you understand a little less. I'll leave you with one last challenge. And this one is specifically for those of you on the older end of the spectrum. If this isn't the place that you interact with young people, I hope you have some place in your life where you do. I urge you to nurture those connections. Go to the young people where they are. Sometimes there aren't many of them here. Build those relationships. Offer support. Show up. Share your stories. Be persistent. Even if they don't understand why they need you, be the elder and be there anyway. It won't be easy, but I believe that it's some of the most important work that we can do to heal our society and to build our capacity to deal with what's coming down the road. Even if many of you won't be there, the young people that you're in relationship with now will be. So what can you pass on now that will help to equip them for the future that we are all bound for? I look forward to hearing some of your thoughts in the discussion in the farmhouse after the service. And for now, let's sing Lean on Me, number 1021 in the Teal Hymnal.